He gets beat up on the way down, like waves are hitting him as he's descending in the strap attached to the hoist cable. He unhooks, he's in the water. He has no idea where the father and son are. He can't see above 40-foot waves. He's being lifted on the crest, dropped into the trough, the wind, the helicopter. He's on his own in the water. So Jeff sees the spotlight spotting ahead. So he starts swimming up the waves, down the troughs, up the waves, down the trough. He arrives in the location of the father and son, Jim and Clint Blades. And he says, as they're trained to do, "I'm Jeff Tunks, United States Coast Guard rescue swimmer. I'm here to get you out." And the father turns to Jeff and says, "Do you think you can get us out of this?" And Jeff says, "We do this shit all the time." So, of course, he had never done this before.
Welcome to Heroes Behind Headlines. I'm your host, Ralph Pizzullo. Our guest today is Coast Guard veteran and author, Martha J. LaGuardia Cotite, to tell us inspiring stories of risk and self-sacrifice from her book, So Others May Live, Coast Guard Rescue Swimmers, Saving Lives, Defying Death. A graduate of the U.S. Coast Guard Academy with a master's from Harvard University, Martha rose to the senior rank of captain and is an award-winning author of 5 books. The Coast Guard's Helicopter Rescue Swimmer Program was developed to assist incapacitated people in the water following the sinking of the vessel Marine Electric 30 nautical miles off the coast of Chincoteague, Virginia, on February 13, 1983, and the crash of Air Florida Flight 90 into the District of Columbia's 14th Street Bridge 1 year before. Since its inception, the program has yielded more than 10,000 rescues at sea and some of the greatest maritime rescue stories ever told. Martha J. LaGuardia Cotite is here to share some of them with us. It's my great honor to welcome her and the brave men and women of the Coast Guard Rescue Swimmers as today's Heroes Behind the Headlines.
Heroes Behind Headlines with Ralph Pizzullo.
Let's start out with you introducing yourself and telling us about your background and how you became associated with the Coast Guard and why.
Thank you so much, Ralph, for having me on your podcast. I've been looking forward to this and I'm honored to be one of your guests.
Oh, thank you. We're honored to have you as a guest.
I started out living in a small fishing village in Northwest Florida. And what happened was I had a tragedy in my family. My older brother took his life. And then I realized how short and fragile life can be and decided I wanted to live a life that made a difference. And so a couple things started to come together in that my father also said he wasn't going to pay for my college. So I'm thinking, whoa, how am I going to get a great education? And I knew I didn't want to stay in the fishing village and marry a fisherman. Not that I have anything against fishermen, but I wanted to get out and see the world and get a great education. But most importantly, live a life that made a difference. And if I could, in some way, save lives. Mm-hmm. So I first started to explore the academies. My father had encouraged me to apply to them. And I applied to them, didn't get accepted to any of them. So I spent a year at Auburn University in the Navy ROTC. And I realized during the mid-80s that life in the Navy was not something I was interested in doing. There were a lot of restrictions on what women could do. And I re-looked at the Coast Guard and the Coast Guard Academy and realized if I wanted to fly planes, if I wanted to drive boats or work in operations ashore, there were no restrictions based on gender. And guess what? I could save lives. I could live a life that made a difference.
Yeah.
So I applied to the Academy. And this time, the second go round, I got in and off I went. That was
fantastic.
My way into the Coast Guard.
And how long have you been in the Coast Guard, or were you in the Coast Guard?
Yeah, I served for over 30 years in uniform at sea and ashore.
Fantastic. And what led you to write this book? Had you ever written a book before? How did it come about?
I had never written a book before. And what happened was on my first patrol, so I graduated from the academy, got my commission as ensign. And back then, we all were sent to ships. So mine was on the Pacific coast out of Oregon. And off we went. First patrol was the Exxon Valdez oil spill.
Wow.
So I'm on this small cutter relative to larger Navy ships, 210 feet long. We're rolling in to help with the Exxon Valdez oil spill, which was this massive oil spill, the biggest at the time.
Yes, I remember.
And as you know, years later, there was the BP oil spill in the Gulf, which I also helped with that. But back to this one, and the captain's looking at his crew of 65 people, mostly men, my roommate and I were the only women, and said, I need someone to help the people of these small towns in remote Alaska know what we're doing. I need a spokesperson. I need someone to talk to the press. And no one raised their hand.
Mm-hmm.
And this was at a time when the military really didn't want to talk to the press. And it was also considered a dead-end role position.
Yeah.
Because flying or commanding a ship were obviously...
Right. That's where the action was. Yeah.
Yes. So I raised my hand and I said, I'll be the spokesperson. And I found I really loved it.
Mm-hmm.
Telling people what we were doing to help them and how we were making a difference. And I, of course, there could also be bad news stories, good news stories. So I fell in love with that role and felt that I could do a good job at it. And so it just really snowballed from there. And I became known as a storyteller, someone that was willing to stand up in front of the camera, do these tough interviews for all sorts of situations across our service. And after a couple more assignments down the road, I ended up in the Pacific Northwest again, after serving on a patrol boat in the Caribbean and out of Key West, Florida. I went back to the Pacific Northwest, this time Seattle, and with 5 days of training was given the big job of being the spokeswoman for the Pacific Northwest, representing the Admiral. And I had a staff and an office called Media Relations, Public Affairs. And I walked in one day and I asked the chief, I said, hey, what are you guys working on? And they were working with a television show about a reenactment of a story of a rescue swimmer that saved lives taking place on the Oregon coast. And as I dug into it a little bit more, I learned that they had to fly the Coast Guard helicopter partway into the cave to retrieve the rescue swimmer. And I was like, what? Hold on. I'll stop. What did you just say? So I had no idea. I'd been 6 years in the service, serving all over the place, at sea, ashore, in operations. Had no idea that we had this caliber of a hero doing these extraordinary things. And this rescue swimmer's name was Tristan Heaton. And in that moment, I resolved that I've got to figure out how to bottle all this up and preserve this history, because no one was interested in the Coast Guard at that time.
So can you talk about what led to the rescue swimmer program? Because there were two dramatic events that led to the creation of that particular group.
That's right. There were two significant events on the heels of decades of people in the aviation community recognizing we can do better.
Yeah.
We need to have to perfect our capability of helping those who cannot help themselves, in particular, those who are hypothermic or incapacitated.
Yeah.
So when we think about the maritime environment, either near shore or out at sea, it's very dangerous. And Mother Nature is so powerful and deserves our respect.
Absolutely.
And lots of times people get themselves in trouble for one reason or the other. Sometimes they're accidents. Sometimes they just didn't think ahead. And so the Coast Guard had folks in the aviation community who was looking at the data and realized there's more that we can do. How do we figure this out? So SARWET was the initial impetus for figuring out how do we train to be safe ourselves, not incur more risk, but help those who are at great risk and can't help themselves. So before I get to the two incidents, if I can go back just a little bit to that.
Sure, sure.
So in the 70s, this volunteer group of aviators were flying these amphibious helicopters, which they could land on the water if the sea stayed allowed.
Yeah.
And they would literally toss a coin. If they lowered the rescue basket down to, say, someone had broken their leg and was stuck on a rock out on the water near the shoreline, and you can't get to them any other way, they would lower the rescue basket. And if they couldn't get them in the basket or get them to get in the basket, they literally flipped a coin to decide who would go down to effect the rescue. So that meant even the co-pilot would have to go down.
Right.
And it was dangerous.
Sure.
So now you're talking about a situation where you're adding more risk to the mix. Either you send someone down in the basket to help that person get in, or if the sea stayed allowed, land the helicopter.
Yeah.
So in all these situations, the helicopter could ditch, could create more problems. Everyone could die. So they practice other ways of how do we use a strap? How do we do the basket hoist better, different? What can we do? And all along the way, we're seeing that people are dying because we can't act fast enough. Hypothermia is acting faster.
Yeah.
So while they're trying to figure out how to make a better difference without incurring too much risk because they could train for it, they found that it wasn't largely supported. And the programs died on the vine, if you will. There wasn't any money in to support expanding it and growing a training program. So the first main incident that happened was when Flight 90, Air Florida Flight 90, do you remember, flew into the Washington, D.C. 14th Street Bridge?
I used to go over that bridge all the time. Yeah.
Yeah. So on this particular day in January, the Potomac was iced up. And I don't know if you've seen it. I mean, it's just
I've seen it.
Crazy when you have a river like that iced, and then you have snow delaying this aircraft at the airport for a couple hours. And when it did take off, it was in the middle of rush hour. So these cars were backed up on the 14th Street Bridge. No one could go anywhere. Snow is coming down. It's this monster blizzard coming into town. And the ice-laden wings on this aircraft prevented it from gaining lift, and it careened into the 14th Street Bridge. So, of course, imagine how tragic and such a disaster this is.
Horrible, yeah.
So now you have a plane in a frozen river. You have people that are quickly becoming hypothermic. They can't help themselves.
Yeah.
They can't grab that life ring that was tossed out from shore with a rope attached to pull themselves in. They can't do it. The life jackets were wrapped in plastic. They couldn't use their teeth or their hands to take it off and take it out of the plastic and help themselves. So it was a very big tragedy. We got a lot of bad press. We couldn't get there by sea or by air because of the storm.
Yeah.
So there were some folks from the SAR-WET era who knew about those who had trained. They cobbled together that information. They said, we have to do better. We have to figure out a way.
Yeah.
So one of them was Dana Goward, who was in a position to make a difference because he worked in policy at headquarters for the Coast Guard in Washington, D.C. So he got together with folks that knew about what they had tried to do in the past and created a training plan that was now sitting on the shelf waiting for funding.
Mm.
So then the second event happens within a year. And this time it was off the coast of Virginia. It was this container ship, like 600 feet, that started to break up in a massive storm with heavy waves.
Wow.
And in this case, all but three people survived. I think it was 24 on the ship, 24, 27.
Yeah.
So 24 perished, three survived, and the others had died. Guess what? What did they die from? Hypothermia.
Right.
So again, this time, the American public was outraged. Congress was, you know, appealed to make a difference, figure out how to get this done better. So they funded that plan that was on the shelf. And by 1985, we had our first rescue swimmers graduate from the gruesome, not gruesome, I should say that, grueling.
Grueling.
It may have been gruesome at some points, but grueling is the better word.
Yeah.
School in Pensacola, run by the Navy at that point. So that's when it began in 1985.
So the whole idea was to, when you have these tragedies, before the Coast Guard was trained, just to fly over in a helicopter and lower a basket, and the people were sort of on their own to get into the basket or swim to the basket. And now the idea is to lower swimmers into the water, which could be, you know, freezing. I mean, terrible, pounding waves, 30, 40-foot waves, and help these people get into the basket or get into a sling or whatever so that they could get pulled up. So, I mean, it was a job that took tremendous physical strength and courage at the same time.
Oh, tremendous courage to risk your life to save others who are in dangerous, crazy, chaotic situations. And usually that's when the shit hits the fan, right? Is it's just extreme.
Yeah. And out in the middle of the ocean or in just horrible, horrible, the worst conditions.
The worst conditions, exactly.
Yeah.
So we were adding a person to the helicopter so that the co-pilot wouldn't have to go down in the basket or someone that was needed in the cabin to run a hoist.
At exactly 4:01 in the afternoon of January 13th, 1982, after just 31 seconds in the air, Air Florida Flight 90 fell out of the swirling snowstorm and plowed directly into stopped traffic on the 14th Street Bridge, connecting Washington and Arlington across the Potomac River. The wings and tail section smashed into six cars, a crane truck, and the guardrail, sending the 737 cartwheeling nose first into the river. 56 of the 78 passengers and crew aboard died instantly, while another 17 suffered severe injuries that precluded any possibility of escape. As the remains of the 737 sank beneath the freezing water, only six badly injured survivors floated to the surface, clinging desperately to the overturned tail section as their arms and legs fell numb from the biting cold. Four passengers and one flight attendant were rescued in acts of stunning heroism as military personnel from the Pentagon raced to the scene to help in rescues, and others on the river's edge threw in makeshift lifelines, some fashioned out of belts or battery cables, to survivors thrashing about in the water. Roger Olean, a sheet metal worker who was stuck in the traffic jam, jumped into the water, but he had to be reeled back in when he got stuck on the ice. Lenny Skutnik, a Congressional Budget Office assistant, plunged into the Potomac and was able to tow passenger Priscilla Tirado to shore. Don Usher and Gene Windsor, two Park Police helicopter pilots, managed to pull out four people. Military veteran and bank manager Arlen Williams was one of six aboard the aircraft to initially survive. He drowned after dramatically passing the helicopter rescue rope to others. In 1985, the 14th Street Bridge was renamed in his honor. All right, so let's talk about Tunks.
Okay.
Because he's sort of one of the first rescue swimmers, as I understand.
Yes, Jeff Tunks, yes.
And if you could just describe the situation that he was faced with and then the action he took. The heroism of these people is just incredible.
Yes, it is. And again, the impetus for me writing this book and bottling up these legendary stories to preserve the stories of heroism for themselves and for their grandkids and for, you know, letting the world know that we have these amazing people.
Absolutely.
So the irony of Jeff's story, if you will, was that he had just completed the rescue swimmer school, and off he went to his first air station, which was in Sitka, Alaska. And this was in December of 1987 that his case took place. And it was a storm of unforecasted ferocity. This was like a badass storm coming across the Gulf of Alaska. The winds were careening down like a bullet train down the side of a dormant volcano called Mount Edgecombe.
Wow.
And this father and son were stuck on some rocks. They had stayed there, missed the weather forecast, and were stuck for the night, kind of unaware of what was coming, because this was before GPS. So nowadays we can look at our phones, right, and see what's happening with the weather. to the hour.
Yeah.
So back in the day, there was nothing like that. And you had to listen to these radio reports of extreme weather coming in at the last minute. And that was pretty much what happens on the West Coast. And you probably know that from Los Angeles, living there, that things can come up in an instant.
Absolutely.
So we have this monster storm coming down the side of Mount Edgecombe. We have this father and son trapped on this 26-foot wooden fishing vessel. And it's nighttime.
Wow.
There is snow. There is ice. There is wind. And it's all kicking up the seas in this, what normally could be a calmer area protected from the Gulf of Alaska. But now it's not, because you've got this system just destroying any peace.
Yeah.
So the Jim at first didn't want to make a Mayday call, but he did. As soon as his boat got hold on the rocks, he's now taking on water. He had a car horn for a bilge alarm, and it was started to sound off, so he knew he was taking on water. So he puts his son in a survival suit, and he gets himself in a survival suit, makes a Mayday to the United States Coast Guard in Sitka, Alaska. They pick up the call, and the SAR alarm goes off, and Jeff Tunks walks out on the tarmac before he gets on the helicopter. He's looking up at the moonless sky with the ice pelting down on his face, and he's thinking, why me? And part of that question had to do with, he had never done a rescue before.
Yeah.
And no one in the United States Coast Guard had ever done a rescue with a rescue swimmer outside the safety of a training scenario, because the pilots, ironically, did not want to incur more risk by sending a rescue swimmer out. They're like, we've done it this way from the beginning. Why do I need a rescue swimmer?
Yeah. And then I'm responsible for that person as well.
Right. So up to this point, rescue swimmers were told to sit in the back of the helicopter. Up here in Alaska, we don't get many fires, and you're like firemen. So if we do get a fire, we'll let you know. But otherwise, just sit in the back.
Yeah.
So on this particular night, Jeff was sitting in the back of the helicopter. The pilots and crew are now lifting off from the tarmac. They're flying across the Sitka Bay towards the last known position reported by Jim Blades, somewhere near Viscari Rocks, which was on that downside of the dormant volcano. So as they get across, it's just terrible. And I describe it better than I can say it now in the story itself. But imagine being, you have to have certain amount of forward motion, at least what, 80 knots to be flying.
Yeah.
So they're being pushed backwards.
Yeah.
And they're doing full power forwards, and the aircraft, the helicopter, still being pushed backwards by the strengths of these winds.
Yeah.
It's snowing, visibility's low, and they're looking for a light that Jim Blades is now flashing in the night.
Yeah.
I'm over here. I'm over here.
Yeah.
They finally see the light and they head for it again, multiple times getting redirected by the winds. And at one point they arrive just above the light and they get pushed 6 miles to the east, 6 miles,
my God.
Just like that, by a gust of wind. It's just incredible.
Wow. Yeah.
So they navigate back towards the light. And at this point, Jim has to get in the water because his boat has pretty much sunk. So he attaches his son to his safety suit, survival suit. And Jim Blades, the father, couldn't zip his suit up all the way because the toggle wasn't there for some reason. So he's starting to take water on into his survival suit. So he's beginning to get hypothermic. And pretty soon he's not going to be able to use his hands, his mouth, or anything.
Yeah. And his son is 6 years old,
yes,
I believe.
Yes, son is attached to him, thank goodness, because that's the only way he could stay next to him.
Yeah.
So the story goes on, as, and I interviewed Jeff Ford and the air crew, just in phenomenal, extreme skill by these pilots, multiple attempts to hover over Jim Blades and lower the basket. And each time the seas are so tall that they're picking up the basket, dropping it in the trough, the Blades can't get in. They cannot get in the basket. So at one point, and keep in mind, this helicopter is constantly being pushed back to like 10 feet above the surface. They're nearly ditching, but they're determined to save these people. So John Wooden, the pilot, one of the two pilots, is now realizing we can't do this without the rescue swimmer.
Yeah.
So he calls back to Jeff on the inner communications and the headsets and says, Jeff, it's dangerous. You have a choice. Do you want to go? And he's like, put me in. I'm here to do my job.
Wow.
So keep in mind, Jeff has never done a rescue outside the safety of a training scenario.
Yeah.
So he goes into this chaotic, very dangerous, extreme situation. He gets beat up on the way down, like waves are hitting him as he's descending in the strap attached to the hoist cable. He unhooks, he's in the water. He has no idea where the father and son are. He can't see above 40-foot waves.
Wow.
He's being lifted on the crest, dropped into the trough, the wind, the helicopter.
And he's on his own by this
point. On his own in the water.
Yeah.
So
incredible.
The pilot decides, well, let me try to get the spotlight on the blades. And maybe that's a way to communicate to Jeff Tunks that that's where they are.
That's where they are. Yeah.
So Jeff sees the spotlight spotting ahead. So he starts swimming up the waves, down the troughs, up the waves, down the trough. He arrives in the location of the father and son, Jim and Clint Blades. And he says, as they're trained to do, I'm Jeff Tunks, United States Coast Guard rescue swimmer. I'm here to get you out. And the father turns to Jeff and says, do you think you can get us out of this? And Jeff says, we do this shit all the time. So, of course, he had never done this before. Oh, my goodness. It just goes into more chaos of them trying to get the basket there. Somehow he manages, after multiple attempts, Jeff manages to get the father and son into the basket. They are shot out of the water as a wave drops out below. Boom, they're gone. The guy running the hoist is like trying desperately to stop them from swinging as they're now hoisted up closer and closer to the helicopter. And they're brought inside. Now they have to get Jeff.
Wow.
Oh, my goodness. And the weather's not getting any better. It's, if anything, it's getting worse. So
yeah.
After a few attempts, Jeff does get locked into the strop. He's now attached to the hoist. He's like, you know, thumbs up, get me out of here. He shoots out of the water. He's tossed back a football length, dragged through the waves. He's beat by the waves. And at one point, would you believe the helicopter's being pushed back? Jeff's in the front of the helicopter in the water because it got pushed back. So his cable is now in the front. In the water, I can't even imagine.
Yeah, and this is extremely dangerous just in terms of the helicopter, too, because if the cable gets caught up in the rotor, or he gets slammed into the helicopter, I mean, that's the end of Jeff.
Yeah, they almost ditched multiple times, and John Wooden will tell you, as will the other air crew, that at one point when they thought they were going in, they were ditching, it was their last minute alive, he felt this presence in the helicopter. And he turns around to tell Carl Saylor to get back in his seat. It's not safe. Get back.
Yeah.
And he noticed Carl was in his seat. He's like, what is that presence? And at that moment, this powerful presence contributed, he feels, to stopping them from ditching. And he was able to pull full power again, get out of that terrible situation and get back into trying to save everyone that's in the water.
Wow.
So they eventually get Jeff back in. This helicopter is grounded for weeks. It has gone through such strain and stress, and the people are, you know, the pilot and crew are just beyond adrenaline-packed rescue. It's incredible.
Yeah.
But they saved two lives, and they certainly put
fantastic
their own on the line. And
I hope Jeff was awarded for this.
He was awarded the awards, as were the pilots and crew. And the significance of this case, if you look at it historically, is it forever turned non-believers, people who didn't believe in this community of heroes called the rescue swimmer, turned them into believers. And so now they're accepted and they're part of the crew. And the look at what they've done since. Incredible.
Right. What a story. Amazing. Was this picked up by the media at the time? At all?
In Alaska. Yeah, in Alaska they were. And I know the Coast Guard Foundation helped promote the fact that this had happened with mostly through the Coast Guard community, the Coast Guard family, people that like the Coast Guard, which are usually in the maritime or aviation industry. The reason I wanted to also write this book was to pull these legendary stories onto paper.
Absolutely.
And to interview these heroes because largely the American population and the world had no idea about the Coast Guard rescue swimmer and the service itself.
Yeah. I can't think of anything more heroic than what Jeff did. And the pilots, I mean, the power of the wind and the waves and storms like that is just something you don't want to mess with.
No, you don't want to mess with Mother Nature.
Could just crush you at any time.
Right.
Wow.
Yeah.
Experts have summarized what happens to the human body when immersed in cold water into four distinct stages. The first one is cold shock. Falling into cold water provokes an immediate gasp reflex, which causes panic, hyperventilation, and increases a heart rate, which can lead to heart attack. This stage lasts about 3 to 5 minutes. Following that is the second stage, where the body will experience swimming failure due to loss of muscle coordination. That is why it is not recommended to swim for help, but remain with the boat or something else that floats while keeping your head above water while awaiting rescue. True hypothermia sets in after 30 minutes, which usually renders a person unconscious. Most victims will never make it to this stage, since 75% of individuals succumb and die in the earlier stages of cold water immersion. The fourth stage is post-rescue collapse. When a person is removed from cold water, blood pressure often drops. Inhaled water can damage the lungs, and heart problems can develop as cold blood from the extremities is released into the body core. Immediate and proper medical attention is essential to rewarm the body safely. I love the story of the two brothers in the cave that you referenced before.
Yeah, Tristan's story was, when I found out about that, that's the one that inspired me to write this book. Mm-hmm. And of course, I had no idea what I was doing.
Well, you did a great job. The stories, they're really well told.
Thank you. Thankfully, Tristan agreed to the interview because a lot of these heroes are so humble.
Yeah.
They don't want to be in the spotlight. To them, they're doing their job. No, I don't want to be interviewed about something that was my world of work. And in fact, after I got to know quite a few of them because of writing this book and interviewing, I learned that many of them have a Distinguished Flying Cross, which is a medal for extreme valor, you mm-hmm. know, related to an aviation rescue mm-hmm. in a shoebox under the bed.
Yeah. It's sort of like that World War II veteran mentality.
Yes.
You know, you do it and you move on. And
yes.
You don't talk about it.
Yeah. So Tristan's story is titled To Almost Die, and it took place on the Oregon coast. Again, the power of the Pacific Ocean is, and any ocean, and Mother Nature was one of the elements in this rescue. And it was unusual because there was an El Nino on this particular day. So we had salt water sweeping into the mouth of this cave on Cape Lookout on the Oregon coast. And when the helicopter got called to rescue, what was reported by people that were hiking up above, they saw two people go into the cave and never come out. Mm-hmm. They made a call saying, you know, we don't know where these people went. They need help.
Yeah.
So the helicopter is now hovering above the cave and they can hear the roar of the water rushing into this cave.
And it's a huge cave you describe.
The width of it is huge, as tall as the Statue of Liberty, the width of it. And there's some height of it as well. But like Jeff's case, this is another example of we've never trained for going into a cave before.
Yeah.
So they're figuring it out on the fly, if you will.
Yeah.
So they lower the rescue swimmer, Therese and Heaton, down near the cave along the beach side. And he has to detach from the hoist cable. He's now completely not attached to the helicopter. He doesn't have a rope that he's bringing in should he need to pull himself out.
Yeah.
You know, all of this was after the fact. You think, oh, maybe he should have brought a rope in, or maybe this should have happened.
Right.
He enters the cave. He's not able to communicate by the radio now. There's no comms, probably because of the interference and the cave itself.
Yeah.
Going back on a ledge into the cave, and he sees one survivor on the other side on a ledge. So he goes into this water. So he cleared like the mouth of the cave, and now he's back in the deeper part of it.
Mm-hmm.
And have you ever seen logs in the Pacific that are waterlogged, trees that are waterlogged?
Yeah.
Okay. And those are heavy, powerful, and strong, right? Even though.
Right.
And so they're bouncing around this cave like toothpicks.
Yeah.
So he's having to avoid that danger. He gets up.
Slamming in with the wave.
Yeah. Pushing with the wave and the currents and this whole mix of stuff going on in the cave.
Right.
He gets up to one of the two brothers, introduces himself. I'm Tristan Heaton, United States Coast Guard. I'm here to get you out.
Yeah.
And the brother is on this little ledge, balled up in fear.
Yeah.
And he's not leaving the ledge. He is not going anywhere. And he relays that his older brother had just done a Spider-Man on the side of the cave, trying to get out of the water to something safe, and was never seen again. So one brother has been lost, presumed deceased. The other's taken safety on this little ledge on the side back of the cave, and Tristan can't get him out.
Yeah.
So they're trained to deal with people that are in a panic mode such as this. He convinces the guy to get off. I'm going to help you. We have to get out of here. We're going to swim out. Come with me. So the man gets off the ledge and now pounces on Tristan as it, like a cat would do,
yeah,
not liking the water.
Right.
So Tristan had to take care of business as they're trained to do, you know, calm him down with a punch or some kind of arm control.
Yeah.
To get him compliant.
Yeah.
Now they're trying to swim out and he gets stuck behind what he called four washing machines on a spin cycle blocking the exit. The power of this turbulent ocean flowing into the cave, getting kicked back out by the back of the cave, all getting caught with these spinning tidal waves. It's a mess. He can't communicate to the helicopter. It's just him and the survivor, and he has to save his life and save his own life.
Right.
So being blocked by this wall of water, if you will, that's spinning around.
And the logs flying around and so on. Yeah.
They start drowning. And
yeah,
he remembers being under the water, trying to preserve his breath. He has the gentleman in his arms. He's going limp. And at some point, by miracle, they are popped up. He can take another breath and he sees USCG painted on the bottom of the helicopter. Every helicopter has USCG on the bottom of it. And he's renewed with hope. His air crew, in an unprecedented fashion, has decided we're going to fly the helicopter partway into the cave to get close enough so that we can drop the rescue basket by cable and let the currents pull it back to where Tristan is.
Yeah. Wow. So they actually fly into the cave.
Partway into the cave.
Wow.
To Tristan, it seemed like all the way in the cave. But when I did a little more research on it, apparently it was most of the way, partway into the cave.
Yeah.
So you've got these rotors now spinning inside the cave.
Oh my God. And so the pilot's got to be like an amazing, amazing pilot because you've got all this wind and you've got to watch that the rotors don't slam into the sides of the cave and hold it steady.
So there, he now sees USCG on the bottom of the helicopter. He's renewed with hope.
Wow.
He convinces the survivor to help me help you get in the basket.
Yeah.
And normally he would release the basket so that the helicopter flight mech can now coach the pilots. You know, I have the basket. I'm beginning to pull it out, how to back out. They become the co-pilot and the flight mech are now eyes for the pilot.
Yeah.
Who's got to carefully and gingerly move back out of the cave.
Yeah.
So Tristan knows how dangerous this is. He's like, there's no way I'm waiting for the basket to come back. I'm hanging on now.
Yeah.
So while it was an extra load, he was like, I've got to stay with it. So he hung on, you know, grips it with his elbow through the basket, weaving there of the steel. The survivors inside, they're being pulled out. And, you know, they survived, the two of them.
Yeah, incredible. And again, I hope he got some kind of recognition for this.
Yes, absolutely. Everyone in my book that I've honored with their legends being included, and these are the legends they wanted told.
Yeah.
Because I made sure I asked them, what are the stories you want to be documented and preserved?
Yeah.
And so that's why these, for the most part, are selected. And I also did a lot of research to review every case to make sure I didn't miss anything.
Yeah.
But the sad thing about Tristan's case I'll share with you, which isn't so uncommon, mm-hmm. was that after this rescue, imagine what you go through when you are experiencing a near-death situation like that. I mean, I have not been in that situation.
No.
But I can imagine the nightmares, the reliving of the experience where you think you might die.
Yeah, sure.
So shortly after the cave rescue, which no one had been trained to do before, but now it's part of Rescue Swimmer Advanced training, one more training that they do.
Really? Oh, they train for that now?
Yes.
Yeah.
So a lot of what's happened before is immersed now into a new advanced rescue swimmer school, which has been around for a while, but it didn't exist in the beginning.
Right.
So it's evolving with the types of situations they get caught in.
Right.
So shortly after the cave rescue, Tristan is called to go on to the side of a cliff where an airplane has crashed. And he sees a horrific sight. Everyone has perished.
Mm.
And I think that was just enough, combined with all the things he'd done as a hero and as a lifesaver,
yeah.
that he recognized, or his colleagues also recognize, it's time for you to get some help.
Yeah.
Because now he's dealing with post-traumatic stress.
Sure.
So he had to leave what he loves and committed his life to do. He had to leave the Coast Guard and leave lifesaving.
Yeah.
And the beautiful thing is he got help at the VA hospital in San Diego and has since become a counselor, counseling those veterans who have PTSD. And he tells them, here's my story. It's in this book called So Others May Live. Read it.
Yeah.
And I can help you.
Right.
So I think that's a beautiful turn of events.
Many believe that post-traumatic stress disorder, better known as PTSD, is a condition that affects only those who have come back from war, but that's not the case. Research shows that individuals who suffer from PTSD have experienced severe trauma at some point in their lives. The trauma could come in the form of a dramatic rescue, as in the case of Tristan Heaton, or a natural disaster, a car accident, a sexual assault, or anything that would prompt someone to have a harrowing reaction. Many of the individuals who suffer from PTSD continue to battle their traumas across their lifetime. According to the National Alliance on Mental Illness, PTSD affects 3.5% or 8 million adult Americans. And approximately 30% of people diagnosed with PTSD display serious symptoms. While the root cause of PTSD is a traumatic event, the symptoms are what overwhelm people to the point where it is diagnosable. These include flashbacks, night sweats, insomnia, panic attacks, and isolating themselves from friends and family. People with PTSD often have recurring, distressing, and upsetting memories of the trauma that are hard to stop. Fortunately, PTSD is treatable with medication and various forms of psychotherapy. And now, can you tell us about one woman's rescue swimmer in this book?
So Kelly Moak, would you believe, is the first woman of any U.S. military service to become a rescue swimmer.
Wow.
Yeah. And so she was, of course, the first for us and the first for all military. Her case took place in 1989 in the Pacific. You picked a lot of Pacific cases, Ralph.
Yeah. I wonder why.
And what uh-huh. happened was they got a call to Air Station Astoria, got a call to rescue a downed F-4 pilot with the Oregon National Guard. So the plane went down.
Yeah.
And apparently there were two pilots. And when they were in and out of fog flying to the beacon that was broadcasting the last known position. And she's sitting in the door of the helicopter above the scene, and she sees these 20-foot seas washing over this pilot who's entangled in his parachute, and he's got a little life raft there that he's hanging on to. She knows it's a real bad situation, and imagine the waves just coming over and splashing across his face. You know, how can you breathe through something like that? And you've already ejected out of a fighter plane. You're now in the water, and you're all tangled up, and she's his last hope.
And this is 35 miles offshore.
Yes.
So you're way out in the ocean there.
And how cold is it there?
Oh my God. I don't even want to think about it.
Yeah. The kind of place you don't want to be more than like a minute in my book.
That's right.
So she's there and she recognizes that there's a lot of entanglement going on. So when she drops down and releases from the hook, if you will, the strap attaching her to the cable, which attaches her to the helicopter, she dives below to inventory what's the situation. And she sees like a bowl of spaghetti with lines everywhere, hundreds of lines all entangled. She sees the parachute is full and open, but in the water.
Yeah.
And it's pulling him down.
Wow.
And somehow this pilot is hanging on with one arm draped over the little life raft, which is barely inflated at this point. And she sees that he's got a broken leg because it was like all twisted and turned.
Mm-hmm.
Turns out he has two broken arms and a broken leg.
Oh my God.
And his lips are purple. He's muttering something she can't understand. His eyes aren't alert, but recognizing that she's there. So he's still alive.
Yeah.
Barely hanging on. So what happened was apparently she would find out later that when he ejected from the fighter plane, apparently they were tumbling and turning and banged on things. And when he lands on the surface of the Pacific Ocean, it's like landing on concrete.
I bet. Yeah, sure.
So that also contributed some of his injuries.
This water is very dense.
Yes. So she proceeds to figure out, how am I going to untangle him? Because she knows if she cuts one line, she'll have two lines to deal with.
Yeah.
So she's thinking on the spot, the best strategy is to untangle him.
Yeah.
And of course, she's in her mind, she's not thinking about, are there predators?
Yeah.
Swimming around.
Sharks. Yeah. Yeah.
Focusing on the job at hand.
Right.
So she was able, after I think a period of 20 minutes, to untangle him. And he's just barely hanging on.
Yeah.
And another helicopter was en route because they knew they had another pilot somewhere. They didn't know where, but they needed to find.
Right.
So she's able to help him get into a strop. They couldn't put him in a basket. He was a 6 foot plus tall guy, over 200 pounds.
Wow.
So the best way to pull him out was to hook a strap under his arms, hoist him up, and he's in excruciating pain. He's screaming. They get him into the helicopter, and they're now going to attend to his injuries and get him back to safety. She gets picked up by the second helicopter because they didn't want to wait any longer, not another
second. Just get him to the hospital.
To get him to the critical care.
Yeah.
So it was really an incredible rescue.
So she's now bobbing in the ocean by herself.
Yeah, she's bobbing in the ocean. She gets up, picked up by another helicopter.
Wow.
And she's now becoming hypothermic from being in the water. She had a slight tear in her suit, and she had to take off one of her gloves to help her have more dexterity to detangle him. So now her hand's hypothermic. And again, it's, you know, it's not a good situation when hypothermia kicks in.
Yeah.
They are able in the second helicopter that she's in to fly over where they found the pilot, the second pilot, because some whales were spouting. And I wonder if it's a coincidence that maybe the whales knew something was in the water.
Right. That's funny.
So the pilot didn't see the life raft, and the second pilot, he saw the whales and then said, oh, it's whales. It's not what we thought.
Yeah.
Banks to the right and then sees the life raft and no pilot.
Yeah.
And Kelly was in no condition to go back in the water. So the PJs, the Air Force PJs, had now spooled up and were en route. And they were the ones that dove down and sadly found that pilot. He was under the water. Again, his parachute was fully open under the water, pulling him under. So it's really sad to see that.
Oh, God. And again, I hope she received a commendation for this.
She did. And She was tough to get an interview with. She really, really did not want to talk about it. She felt that she was put up on a pedestal because she was the first woman, and she didn't want to be recognized for being a woman.
Mm-hmm.
She was a rescue swimmer, United States Coast Guard. I'm here to do my job.
Yeah.
And I respect that.
Yeah. And apparently she had a pretty distinguished career in the Coast Guard after that.
Yes, you're right. She became a pilot.
Oh, wow.
So she flew Coast Guard helicopters.
Wow. And you say now there are 6 or 7 female rescue swimmers?
Yeah, I was trying to nail it down exactly. I know there have been 6. There may have been 7.
Mm-hmm.
And to my knowledge, there's only maybe 3 that are still on active duty.
And Kelly was the first?
Kelly was the first.
Kelly Moak Larson enlisted in the Coast Guard in 1984. And in 1986, she became the first woman to complete rescue swimmer school. After several years of enlisted service, Larson attended the Coast Guard's Officer Candidate School and received her officer's commission in 1993. Remaining in an aviation career, she completed naval flight training in Pensacola, Florida, and transitioned to flying the Coast Guard's H-865 helicopter. Her operational flying tours included Air Station Humboldt Bay, California, Air Station Port Angeles, Washington, and the Coast Guard Aviation Training Center in Mobile, Alabama, where she supported the Coast Guard's polar operations mission aboard Coast Guard icebreakers and served as a pilot instructor. In 2009, she retired with the rank of Lieutenant Commander. Larson's list of awards include a Meritorious Service Medal, an Air Medal, 2 Coast Guard Commendation Medals, 3 Coast Guard Achievement Medals, and a Commandant's Letter of Recommendation. She was inducted into the Women in Aviation International Pioneer Hall of Fame in 2019. Next comes an amazing hurricane rescue by rescue swimmer Mario Vitone.
I'd like to read his quote if I can.
Sure, please.
Each swimmer had a quote that I put at the beginning of their chapter, and Mario's was, "We do this job because every once in a while, someone is out there without hope, desperately praying for their life, and we get to be the answer."
Wow. I can just imagine the relationship that's formed between the swimmers and the people that they rescue. I mean, I'm sure those people who are rescued never forget these rescue swimmers their entire lives.
Yes. And the sad part is sometimes the people that they rescue, I don't know why, don't even thank the rescuers. It's crazy.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
And then others have written thank you notes, remember them annually on the holidays with a card and a note.
I guess some people just don't want to remember the incident, or it was just too traumatic to even think about.
Who knows?
Yeah.
Who knows?
That's bizarre.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So Mario's story took place in the Atlantic Ocean. It was interesting how he describes how his day started out.
Mm-hmm.
And he was in the pool at Elizabeth City, North Carolina, training with a salty, you know, veteran rescue swimmer. And they're working out, talking about different ways of rescuing. And they knew, they had heard the weather reports, that this hurricane had crossed from the Gulf of Mexico across the state of Florida and was now in the Atlantic Ocean and starting to grow and build and barrel up the eastern seaboard from Florida.
Mm-hmm.
So Mario just kind of asks Scott Adelon, who was the senior guy there with him in the pool, he says, "Hey, Scott, what do you do if you had a baby?"
Yeah.
No one had ever rescued a baby from the ocean. And
yeah.
So one more of those situations where the program has evolved and has to evolve because you can't plan for everything, right? But when something does happen, you certainly learn from it.
Right. Absolutely.
So they rehearse what they would do. It's important to lift and carry the baby out over your heads to keep it out of the rotor wash. So the rotor wash, mm-hmm. the helicopter blades spin around,
mm-hmm.
and they can create hurricane force winds just on their own.
Wow.
And so when you have hurricane force winds, it also kicks up the water, right?
Yeah, sure.
And so now you have a real hurricane coming up the eastern seaboard.
Yeah. And he didn't know when he first went in that there would be a baby there. In fact,
right.
It was reported, I think it was a
4-year-old, a teenager and a 4-year-old.
Yeah.
Yeah. So good catch on that. So the SAR alarm goes off and the call goes out that we need to go on scene to rescue this sailing vessel. I think it was 64 feet long, pretty decent size.
Yeah.
The Marine Flower 2 with a family on board, mother, father, teenage girl, and a 4-year-old.
Yeah.
So they were sailing to, I think it was Bermuda. So anyway, they were way off the shore.
Yeah.
Way out in the middle of the ocean.
Yeah.
And the pilots, again, kudos to the pilots. Not only are they great at what they do, but they also have to think through a situation so that they can go out and come back.
Yeah.
They quickly realize the sailboat is too far out for them to get there and back with the fuel that they can have in their regular fuel tank, mm-hmm. plus supplemental tanks that they attach to the helicopter.
Mm-hmm.
So the pilots wisely said, we'll do this, but you need to get me something I can refuel on, like an aircraft carrier or a ship out there in the middle of the ocean.
Yeah.
So this was a great rescue done with the help of the United States Navy.
Yeah.
It was an aircraft carrier called the USS America that had not come into port to take shelter from the hurricane.
Uh-huh.
So they launched, they added another fuel tank to the helicopter. They launched and they start flying out. It's a couple hours out before they get to the aircraft carrier.
Wow.
And I'm always amazed at how these stories come together. One of the pilots had served, I think he said, in the Marine Corps and had landed on aircraft carriers before.
Wow.
What are the chances, right?
Yeah.
So when they approached, and Mario was in the Navy before, so he was familiar with aircraft carriers too. So now you have this 1,000-foot long piece of metal in the middle of the ocean. And as they circle around to prepare for landing on the flight deck, they're thinking, oh, S-H-I-P.
Yeah.
There is blue water. The ocean is breaking over the bow of this carrier that's 10 stories tall.
Wow.
Holy moly. And it's like bobbing up and down, right? Like a boat in the bathtub or a plastic boat, maybe.
And as you say, super fortunate that one of the pilots had landed on an aircraft carrier.
Right.
Because otherwise they would have just been like, no way, not doing this.
What are the, yeah.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
So they didn't land just once. This was the first stop to lily pad, if you will.
Yeah.
They had to refuel. So miraculously they landed and they had more visibility. It was still daytime.
Mm-hmm.
And then they had to fly 3 more hours in the helicopter out to the sailing vessel, Marine Flower 2.
Wow.
And they get on scene and they're looking at this mass of the vessels just tossing back and forth with the waves. They see cables and ropes and everything, like sails are in tatters. It's a whole Charlie Foxtrot happening out there. It's a mess.
Yeah. Wow.
So they had thought initially that they could drop Mario to the boat,
mm-hmm.
and get him on board. He would put the, and then now they figured out it's not a 4-year-old. It's a baby.
Yeah.
It's 4 months old.
Big difference.
Oh, 4 months. I can't even imagine. So the family now, they're starting to talk through via radio from the pilots are talking with the sailboat master,
mm-hmm.
The father on the radio about here's what we're going to do.
Yeah.
Because they don't want them to just abandon ship before the rescue swimmer is ready to help them get out of the water.
Yeah.
So they tell them, make sure your life jacket is on.
Yeah.
Wait till we are on scene.
Yeah.
And one by one, we're going to help you. And you're going to have to jump off the boat into the water. So they get Mario dropped by cable behind the sailboat, and he's thinking he could swim up to the back of the boat.
Yeah.
Well, not everyone's a sailor, right?
Yeah.
So if you're a motorboat person, you know that you're going to be motoring if you get out at sea. You're always motoring. It didn't occur to the pilots and crew that this sailboat must have power on.
Yeah.
To stay somewhat comfortable on a course in the water.
Right.
So Mario's back there swimming, and he's not getting caught up to the sailboat because the sailboat has a little motor going and it's making about 3 knots. And that's probably about as fast as he could swim.
Yeah.
Now he's exhausted. He calls for a pickup.
Wow.
They pick him up and he's like, you got to get me close to the boat.
Right. So he hadn't even gotten to the boat yet.
No.
Yeah.
But he's probably nearly exhausted. At least I would be. That would be up for me.
Yeah, sure. Oh, yeah. He tapped out.
Yeah. He found this extra energy. I mean, they're amazing athletes.
Yeah.
They can just go and go.
Yeah.
And
it must be. Yeah.
So they try to drop him closer to the sailboat, avoiding this dangerous mass that could impale the helicopter, could
sure
impale Mario on his way down.
Right.
So they get him as close as they can. And Mario sees that the man, the father, either had a line out or there was a line in the water. So he grabs that line attached to the boat and he wraps it around his hand. And then he's going to start pulling himself up.
Yeah.
But then Mario didn't have nice things to say about this man for all the things that he did. Number one, he shouldn't have put his family on the boat and gone out in front of
him. Yeah, really. I would say with a 4-month-old baby.
Yeah.
Yeah, not too smart. Yeah.
So now imagine being Mario and you've got your hand wrapped with the rope and you're pulling with the other hand to pull yourself closer. And the father's now pulling on the rope, which means it's tightening around Mario's hand, cinching it. So
oh, God.
He has to undo what he was trying to do.
Yeah.
So I imagine there were some choice words said in the water by Mario at that point. I can think of a few I would say.
Yeah, for sure. You're about ready to lose your hand.
Yeah. So now he's closer to the boat and trying to remember who goes off first. I think it's the mother with the baby are standing off the back and she's hesitant because she's, you know, the boat is going up and down, the stern's going up and down, and she doesn't want to jump. I mean, who would, right? Who wants to jump off?
And she doesn't want to let go of the baby.
Exactly. That's probably the most important reason. Who wants to endanger the baby and she's not letting go?
Yeah.
So somehow this larger wave lifts the boat up and she has no choice. She's now off the boat.
Flung off. Yeah.
She's in the water and Mario gets the basket close to her and she's holding the baby. And now he has to get her in the basket, the mom. He has to hold the baby and she's not giving up the baby.
Yeah.
So somehow or another, he's able to get the baby, tells her, get in the basket, then I'll give you your baby back. So the mom's in the basket. Mario's holding the baby. And remember how we talked about keep the baby above the water.
Right.
You don't want the baby to drown. So the mom is reaching. She's in the basket, reaching for the baby through the bales of the basket. And that's dangerous. You can't pull the baby through the basket. It has to go around and above.
Of course. Yeah.
So they're having this little fight now. And if she pulls for the baby, the baby's going to be under the water.
And this is all in the water, in the water.
All in the water.
With waves going up and down and tossing them all over the place.
Yes.
And the helicopter above.
Yes.
Trying to avoid the mask that's
yes.
flipping all over the place.
Yeah. So Mario says later after the case, he says, that was a tough 10 seconds.
Yeah.
Where he's like, I just can't lose the baby. I can't lose the baby. I can't lose the baby.
Yeah.
And so somehow they figure it out. She now recognizes, or he, because of his strength and abilities, is able to hand her the baby.
Yeah.
And off mother and baby go. And they're fine. They're in the helicopter.
Yeah. And he says during the whole time, he looks at the baby. And the baby's just perfectly calm.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, that's a good point.
Everybody else is freaking out and the baby's just like, oh, this is okay.
I'm glad you mentioned that because you're right. That in that moment, seeing the baby in the calm with the calm face in the middle of this chaos.
Yeah.
Helped Mario recognize, okay, we got this.
Yeah.
Right. You and me.
The baby's not afraid.
Yeah. You're right. Not afraid. I'm not afraid.
Right. Right. That's great.
So mother and baby are up. The daughter does this wonderful run, jumps off the back of the boat. And now it's the father that's not won any bonus points at all. He's in the negatives.
Yeah.
Something about he didn't even zip his life jacket. But they pull him out. And then the family's now in the helicopter. And now Mario has to get hoisted up. And his back gets jacked because as on his way up, a big wave comes in and plows into his back on the strap while he's coming up. You know, that's not comfortable.
No. And he says he heard every vertebrae in his back pop.
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
And so once he gets back to the helicopter, he's got to take care of the family. They're all emergency medical technicians. So they're applying, you know, first aid and critical, you know, care before they can get them to a critical care facility.
Yeah. Because as you said, they're 3 hours away, right?
back to the aircraft carrier.
Aircraft carrier.
So they land again. This time it's night.
Mm.
And they're looking at lights to show them
where
the deck is and if moving up or down and how many feet. It's insane. And the Navy wanted to go into port to get out of the storm. And they had asked them, you know, can you hang out here? Because we need to refuel
we need
again.
You. Right, right. Please don't go.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow.
So it was a wonderful cooperation with the United States Navy and the United States Coast Guard. And what heroics by the pilots and Mario.
Incredible. Incredible. And the family, everybody survived.
Everybody survived.
Yeah.
And one of the things I love, if you go to a rescue swimmer shop at an air station, you'll see in the shop what they have as trophies, which are the life jackets from those they've saved.
Oh, okay.
The Marine Flower 2 life jacket of the infant is there, and they write on it Marine Flower 2, the date of the rescue, 4 lives saved, and then they list the crew, pilots, and rescue swimmer and flight mech.
Wow.
And that's for them the trophy and the memory, of course.
Yeah. Yeah. And tell us a little bit about Mario. Did he go on to continue his career as a rescue swimmer, or did he go on to other things?
He talks a little bit about having some challenges in his marriage, and he got out for a little bit, but then he came back in and he had a full career and then retired. And he was so nice. He invited me to be his guest for the premiere of the movie, The Guardian, which used my book. Kevin Costner and Ashton Kutcher both read my book, said they loved it, and they used it to study for their roles in the movie, The Guardian. And Mario invited me to sit next to him at the premiere of the movie. So,
oh, great.
Wonderful person, amazing American hero, too.
Yeah, incredible man. Wow. Incredible stories. We'd love to have you back again to tell us more stories. If you want to bring one of these people with you next time, you're welcome to.
That would be great.
But we would love to highlight like some more of these stories, because they're the heroism is just, you know, remarkable. And the motto and the title of the book is So Others May Live. And that's exactly, you know, what they're doing and putting their own lives at extreme, extreme risk, because these are the most difficult conditions you can imagine.
Yes. And Ralph, kudos to you for recognizing heroes and what they've done, because there are so many that are unsung. And
yes.
So I really appreciate you highlighting people like this group.
It's our honor to do that. Yeah, absolutely.
The Coast Guard is our nation's oldest continuous seagoing service, with responsibilities including search and rescue, maritime law enforcement, aids to navigation, icebreaking, environmental protection, port security, and military readiness. In order to accomplish these missions, the Coast Guard employs approximately 43,000 active duty men and women, more than 8,000 reservists, and 30,000 auxiliary personnel who serve in a variety of fields. The Coast Guard helicopter swimming program, on the other hand, is much more selective and comprised of about 350 active duty members. Its training school has one of the highest attrition rates of any military school, with about 80% of candidates washing out. For comparison, the attrition rate for the Navy SEAL selection and training is about 75%. Male and female candidates need to demonstrate flexibility, strength, and endurance, and must be able to function for 30 minutes in high seas. While the rewards aren't monetary, they're huge in other ways. According to Master Chief Larry Farmer, who helped develop the Coast Guard Rescue Swimmer Program and is a member of the Coast Guard Hall of Honor, quote, "There is no greater gratification than to be part of the saving of another human being. It's indescribable." We thank Martha LaGuardia Cotite for her excellent book, So Others May Live, and for celebrating the heroism of this inspiring group of men and women. It's my great honor to name Martha LaGuardia Cotite and the Coast Guard Rescue Swimmers, also known as Aviation Survival Technicians, as today's heroes behind the headlines.
Heroes Behind Headlines. Executive producer Ralph Pizzullo. Produced and engineered by Mike Dawson. Music provided by Extreme Music. For exclusive content, please join our Patreon group at patreon.com/heroesbehindheadlines.